Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm grand. Shall we begin today by reading a listener email?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Francis and I get a bunch of emails, and please keep sending them. But every once in a while, somebody will ask a question that I think has greater relevance, that might be interesting for everybody. And this is one that was in my inbox recently.
Here's one that's addressed to you. Evidently, this fan, who shall remain nameless, likes you better than me. So.
Well, they know that I'm the more compassionate of partners, so
yeah,
that's probably true. Clearly, anytime you're looking for a compassionate answer, you want to send it to me.
Okay, here you go. Ready? Dear Mark, I subscribe to your podcast, love the show, and have a question for you. I recently ate at my favorite restaurant here in the Boston area, where I'm a regular customer, going there every month or two. It's a first course, second type restaurant. And after being seated, my friends and I had a cocktail and some snacks to start, followed by a first course, second course, dessert, and a cup of coffee. I felt like we ate at a reasonable pace, the pace at which the courses were being served. As we were nearing completion of the dessert coffee and had just gotten the check, a waitress there that I know outside of work was sent over to tell us, very nicely, that there was a big table waiting and, you know, sort of dot, 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 hinting, you know, what you get at. Hinting, can I have that table back, please? From the time we sat down until the time we got the check, 2 hours and 15 minutes had elapsed. Are they in the right, nudging us along at the end of the meal? I love this place, but I'm left with a little bit of a bad taste. I feel like I did something wrong, and obviously that's not the way you want a customer to feel when they leave your restaurant. Is that an unreasonable amount of time? They're a very popular restaurant, and they're booked solid every night, so what's right here? Mark, what's right there?
Well, first of all, I think it depends on a lot of issues. Okay, first of all, what was said here was you were told to move along.
Yeah.
Even in the nicest of ways. I think that it's okay to ask.
Yeah.
If you know, can I? And
well,
it's
not ideal. It's not ideal to ask.
It's definitely not ideal. Okay. Realize that any time that a restaurant owner or a restaurant maitre d' is confronted with this situation, what are they balancing? They're balancing the table that's been waiting a while, what their needs are, and the table that's been sitting for a while, what their needs are. Now, in this case, 2 hours and 15 minutes, I think, for the type of restaurant they're talking about, probably isn't very much time.
Yeah, I would think for a deuce, the standard for that sort of restaurant that I'm aware of is you leave about 2.5 hours on average.
Correct, and even if you left two, you would know that somebody might stay for 2:15 or 2.5.
Here's the idea. Here's the crux of the problem. You know, the thing about restaurants is, you know, this is like a little marriage counseling. If this is a real restaurant where you're a regular and you have a relationship, and he says they send over a waitress that they knew him outside of work as a friend, what's okay to ask and what's not? And I think that to tell someone to get up after 2 hours and 15 minutes is not acceptable.
I totally agree.
You haven't given the person sufficient time. Now, to insist that I had a couple come in and have two drinks at a bar table recently,
mm-hmm.
and they're very nice ladies, enthusiastic about cocktails. I kid you not, they came in at 9:15, they each had a cocktail, and then they split an appetizer. And they were there until about 1:30 in the morning.
Until last call.
So that's about 6 hours. Now, I didn't need the table back, I never even thought about it, I was glad to have them there, it was fine. But if that were a dinner table...
Yeah, and it was 8:45 they arrived.
And we've had tables sit in the dining room,
mm-hmm.
and order appetizer, entree, dessert, and sit at the table for 5 or 6 hours.
Absolutely.
And you know what? When I have the room, I'm happy that
Absolutely.
People view my place as their living room. I want,
Absolutely.
And I want people to view it as a locus of community. You know, and what does it matter if they don't? You know, if they're not spending every minute they're there, that's fine. That is a big difference, by the way, between BYO restaurants and bring your own restaurants and restaurants with liquor licenses. Very often, bring your own restaurants, they need to make revenue, so they can't allow you to linger over coffee and drinks for too long. Whereas a liquor licensed restaurant, if you have a drink or two afterwards, it sort of makes sense. But what happens when that happens on a Saturday night, when you leave 2.5 hours for a deuce or 3 hours for a four top, and a table comes in at 6:30.
And also the answer is if you're good at your job, some tables are going to get up in 2 hours, some tables are going to get up in 3 hours, and that's going to kind of work itself out.
But every once in a while, if you serve thousands of dinners a week,
of
as
course.
We do, you're going to find yourself in a jam on a Saturday night if somebody comes in at 6:30. And here's the other thing. If the restaurant's backed up in the kitchen and the food is served slowly, well, that's the restaurant's problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if everything comes and people are just enjoying themselves, enjoying the space, and enjoying the time, and maybe stay there for 4 hours. I've had dinners in restaurants for 4 hours.
Sure.
Usually I'm ordering old cognac and great wine, so they don't mind. But my point is, somebody comes in at 7:30, you've booked that table again at 10 o'clock, and the people are still there at 11, and you don't have another table for the people who have a reservation. I think it's appropriate at some point to go over and say, you know, I need that table back. I'm so sorry.
Well, let's talk about what I think should have happened in this case.
Okay.
And what would I have done in this position? And I'll talk to Matt from Boston, who wrote this letter. What I probably would have done had I been the proprietor. Now, he mentions that he's friendly with this particular waiter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
Probably what I'm going to do is find someone in the dining room who's completed their meal, who I'm friendly with in some way, who I have some kind of other relationship with,
right,
or a bigger relationship.
Be it a regular customer or a friend from outside the restaurant.
Whatever it may be. And I'm going to try and maybe trade some of my goodwill for a favor. And that's exactly how I'm going to treat this. I'm going to treat this like, can you, and those are the exact words that should be used, I think, in this situation. Can you do me a favor? Can I buy you a drink at the bar? Can I?
You know, it's great. I just want to point out the way that, and we talk to young people about this all the time, and this is not just in the restaurant business, but the way that you just phrased that, and it's obvious it's automatic for us.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a favor. I really
right.
do view it as
Absolutely.
A favor.
Absolutely.
But you would approach it by saying, can you do me a favor and get up and give me your table back? Well, no, that's not what you said. You said, can you do me a favor and allow me to buy you a drink at the bar?
Mm-hmm.
Or allow me to buy you an extra dessert at the bar? Or get you a glass of champagne? And they'll say, what do you mean? I said, I'm in a bit of a jam for a table right now. And be honest with people.
Right.
And you know what? I bet, and please write us back, because I know we responded by email, Matt. But if that person had come up to you and said, you know, you're the regular customer, you're part of the family, and said, you know what? I'm in a bit of a jam. Would you allow me to do you the, can you do me the favor of allowing me to buy you a drink at the bar? You'd have been like, my
sure.
guess is you'd have said, oh, that's, of course, you know, it's yeah. me, it's you, we're family, that's part of it. And I
can't tell you this hasn't been handled incorrectly in my restaurant. It happens sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that long ago that I had a regular customer say, hey, you know, I got kind of pushed a little bit towards the end of my dinner more than I wanted to.
Hey, but I want to say something positive about that customer who's been a regular customer for years. And because it's funny, this happened to us just recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say something to all of you out there, and Matt as well. You're a regular customer there? Send a little note
right.
to call up and say, hey, listen, I love your restaurant, but I just have a few things I want to share with the manager, the maitre d', the owner. Who should I send an email to? And send a note saying, hey, you know what? I love your place, but the last time I was there, this happened, and it left a bad taste in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And when you write a note to a restaurant, please don't ever start off the note with, I had this experience, and I'm never coming there again. Because sometimes with a lot of restaurants we've consulted for, people send crazy emails to restaurants that start off with a rant and a raven. Look, restaurants make mistakes sometimes.
Yep.
But my point is, when a restaurant takes when a patron takes the time out of their day to write a letter of complaint, that's not a, I hate you, you know, we're gonna kill you, I'll never come back again, and says, you know, I had an experience there that wasn't up to my expectations, and here are the positive parts of the evening, and here are the negative parts, and I was really surprised and disappointed. 99 times out of 100, you're going to get some kind of a response from that restaurant where they're going to try and make you happy.
Yep.
And so that's one of the things that I would do whenever you find something like this.
I want to add to what Francis just said. Whenever you're writing to a restaurant or any business, I think, and complaining, being balanced gives you more credibility. Saying, these are the things that went wrong. I've been here before, and you usually do this and this very well, and this didn't happen as well as I expected them to. Having that kind of balanced overview instead of, frequently if I get a complaint, and we don't get a ton of complaints, but if I get a complaint and it's just an over the top, you know, and the salt shaker wasn't the right salt shaker on the table, and you start getting all of these other criticisms, they begin to take away from what the main point of the letter might have been, what the crux of your message was. And I just encourage you to try and have, when you're having a discourse with somebody about this, try and keep it on track to the thing that's upsetting you and not to some other things that you think are buttressing your point but may be actually taking away from them.
Well, and I also think that in any good restaurant, this economy, any economy, when you get a letter complaint from a customer who seems like your kind of customer, you get any complaint, it really you take it very seriously. But when you get a complaint from someone who's dined at your restaurant before, or who says, you know, I'm your kind of customer, you're my kind of restaurant, but it didn't work out that
right.
way. What happened? And every restaurateur I know for an independent restaurant. You know, that we, you know, you call the maitre d' from that night, you see what happened, you not only try to make that customer happy, but you use that to improve your business.
Exactly.
And you say, what went wrong? How did this go wrong? How do we make sure this doesn't happen again? Did we misread the customer? Do we need to retrain somebody? Do we need to change procedure? So those things are really valuable. Don't view it as a negative thing to write a restaurant that you like, especially one that you sort of like, but something went a little bit off.
That's the other thing I'm going to say, especially when it's a place you like. Especially, you know, Matt talked about this is a place that he was considering not going to anymore, that he frequents once a month that he likes because of this experience. Talk to the people who are involved. Number one, I'll bet it never happens to him again. Number two, I'll bet that he's treated as if he did the restaurant not just a favor by getting up, but a favor by pointing this out to them that this happened in a way that they didn't want it to happen. Because I guarantee you, this restaurant, which is Matt says is very busy, is busy for a reason. And one of the reasons I'm certain is customer service.
And you know what, Matt? When you listen to this show, send the link to this restaurant and say, listen to the first segment. It's about you because we left them nameless. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. We're talking today with Charlie Trotter, one of the best chefs in America. Don't leave us. We'll see you in a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And today our guest is the esteemed chef Charlie Trotter of Chicago and around the world.
Chef Charlie Trotter, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back with you guys. Thanks.
Chef, you were one of our early guests way back when we began the show years ago.
I remember when we were on.
Yeah, you know what we did with that? We sent emails to everybody else who wanted to be on the show, and we're like, Trotter was on the show, you got to come. Totally worked.
Before anybody knew who we were, they knew who you were.
I would say, that guy?
Yeah. No, we coattailed on your fame, and you really helped the show to survive.
I've told so many people that this is basically car talk for food.
Oh, you know what? We're going to put that up on the website.
And I mean that in the most positive way. I don't know how often you guys listen to Car Talk, but that's...
All the time.
We do.
You paid us a great compliment that I'm not even sure you're aware of. But about a year after you were on the show, one of our captains went out to Chicago and had dinner at your restaurant. And your staff sort of quickly realized that he was someone who's in the business and showed him some extra courtesy as a result. And whoever was waiting on him said, you know, are you in the business? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm a captain in a restaurant back on the East Coast. And he said, oh, where? And he said, well, in New Jersey, a little place called Stage Left. And the waiter said, much to my captain's astonishment, oh, Stage Left, that's the Restaurant Guy's restaurant. And he said, how did you know that? Well, Chef Trotter was on the show, and then he liked the interview, so he made us all listen to it.
That is a true story. And when we get any kind of notoriety or publicity or any press, we really never share it all with the staff. It's not about that. But I enjoyed our conversation, and once in a while we'll share something with the team. Oh, this was filmed in Europe, or this was taped here, or this was a radio thing. And yeah, I remember they listened to it so as a group, and they were very, because they always want to know, oh, what's Charlie up to? He's kind of crazy, and we know he's going out of town, but what's happening? And I want to share some of my experiences with the team, so that they, if they need to, can be able to share that with the guests. So yeah, that's a true story.
Well, we were pretty impressed, and he was pretty impressed too. He was pretty happy with
and,
that.
And my problem is, my staff's like, I got to listen to you all the time. You want me to listen 45 extra minutes a day?
I deal with that too.
There they go again. Well, so let's talk about you now. You've got a lot of interesting things going on. I want to get to your new book, or the re-release of your book, Home Cooking with Charlie Trotter, which I read through last night. Fascinating and a great cook for, book for home cooks. But your most recent restaurant project is your place out in Las Vegas, isn't that correct?
Right. Well, yeah, the book's been out, and it's not quite a re-release because it's been reworked, and we've even simplified things further and with color images. But it's, you know, it's a way for the home cooking folks to approach basically some very sophisticated food. But yeah, the Las Vegas restaurant's been open about a year, a little over a year, actually, and it's kind of fun for us because we were in Vegas back in 1994. Before the deluge, mm-hmm. It was Wolfgang Puck and us, and we had a comp-only restaurant for about a year and a half, and, you know, due to a disagreement, we decided to go our separate ways, but we've had opportunities to return, but we reopened a year and a month ago, 13 months ago, and it's our way to let our hair down. I mean, it's fine dining in a sense, but on the other hand, it's approachable. It's a la carte. It's seafood-focused. That's part of the restaurant. But the other part, when you walk in the front door, if you go to the other side, there's our version of a sushi bar. And it's maybe 50% authentic, 50%, let's say, interpretation or hybrid. And, you know, it's fun. I mean, it's all with pristine product and everything else.
How do you find Las Vegas?
Well, I like going there. I mean, you know, I know it's one of these polarizing places. It's some people, you know, scoff at Vegas. Other people, you know, they love to hang out there. For me, you know, as a business person, as a restaurateur, it's a great opportunity. You have a lot of people that come out or go out there for reasons beyond just the gambling or the shows. They want to dine. And right now you've probably got about 30 name chefs that have operations out there. So you could just go there strictly on a dining sort of pilgrimage if you wanted to. You wouldn't have to do anything. I mean, what we love is when there's a convention in town or there are business people in town from New York or D.C. or Chicago or L.A., but, yeah, they also want to have a nice dinner out, and they're looking for that. And so it's fun to be part of that fabric.
Well, Vegas has definitely become a dining mecca. A lot of major restaurants now have satellites in Vegas.
From Europe, you've got Robuchon, Ducasse, Guy Savoy, I believe Pierre Garnier is still trying to work out some details with the city center, which I don't know how well they're doing financially. But so you've got some great European chefs, and then you've got top American chefs that have projects there. Danielle Ballou, Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, Emeril, Thomas Keller, Joachim Schlichau. I mean, and they're doing, sometimes they're doing straight-up versions of what they do, but sometimes they're doing, downscaled or steakhouse version or whatever. You know, Todd English has a couple of restaurants. I mean, it's fun because you get people that they're from Tucson, Arizona, and they've, in my case, they've never been to Chicago, but they've heard of Charlie Trotter's, and gosh, they're there, and you know, I can't believe we get to dine here, and so it's kind of nice. I mean, you expose what you do in a different environment.
Charlie, I have a friend who's in the hotel business out in Vegas, and he has just been crying the blues over, I mean, as bad as it is here in New Jersey or in Chicago or New York City, it almost feels like Vegas is getting hit the worst by this. From a conference perspective, exactly. How's that impacting your
I think Vegas is definitely taking a hit, but it's not helpful when the President of the United States says, you know,
don't go to Vegas.
And he said this about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Gosh, people shouldn't be going to places like Las Vegas for business conventions.
Yeah, that was. I think he regretted that too.
That's a good thing to say, because why would you differentiate Las Vegas from Atlanta, from Orlando, from Chicago, from the Javits Center in Manhattan? I mean, these people go and they go on business and they entertain and they do things, but you can't have somebody singling out a city. Given all the other woes, that certainly didn't help things, I know, because a lot of the hotels are slowing down and the restaurants are, you know, wishing, begging for more business, and the city center project has stalled, and that's affecting, you know, the whole dynamic of the city. So, yeah, they're in tricky times right now, just like all the other major cities, for sure.
I think that remark by the president was really unfortunate, and I would think that he would regret it. We all know the point that he was trying to make, because, you know, it's funny because I think he singled out Las Vegas because it is such a center of fun and, you know, such a great place to go. I think we got what he was trying to say, but you can't single out a single city like that.
That's exactly it. And it's not, I mean, 10 years ago, Las Vegas had a different sort of reputation, and for for the last number of years, it's been a great convention city and business city, and people go there. And, yeah, if they want to go to a show or go to a nightclub or visit a fine dining restaurant, that's available too. But when you single out a city and sort of by implication say that it's, you know, inappropriate,
right.
Well, that's not good.
No.
So, you know, Vegas is still reeling from even those simple comments. But when you're in a formidable position as the President of the United States, you've got to watch your words.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's true. I remember my first trip out to Vegas was when the Mandalay Bay opened up. A friend of mine was working for Charlie Palmer as he was a master sommelier, a guy named Stephen Geddes, who's still out there, I think, doing some stuff. And
well, I gave Stephen Geddes his first job.
Oh, did you really?
I did. He worked for me as a waiter.
This is the small world story.
At Charlie Trotter's at the MGM Grand.
I did not
know
that.
After about a year, Stephen was very interested in wine. We said, why don't you go into the wine world? And so then he became a sommelier. So Stephen and I are very close.
Oh, he's a great guy. I met him
He's a great guy. And yet, interestingly enough, he's now more of a chef than he is a sommelier.
I know.
I love that.
He changes his whole persona every few years, is from what I... We met in Austria on a wine buying trip, and then we came back, and he visited us, and me and we went out in New York a few times with some mutual friends. But when Charlie Palmer opened the Mandalay Bay, he invited me out for the opening. And he said, listen, we're going to do a week of wine lunches followed by wine dinners. Why don't you come out and work a couple of them? We'll put you up for the week and you can explore Las Vegas. And I'm not a gambler. So I was out in Vegas for a week and I worked, you know, one lunch shift and one dinner shift over the course of a week. And for the rest, I sort of just played around Vegas and I ate well. And I placed one bet on the roulette wheel and lost $20 on 22. That's what
I was thinking I was going to hear a story of, you know, I don't gamble, but I placed one bet on the roulette wheel, and the next thing I knew, I won $25,000.
Right, the bells were ringing, the showgirls were on.
I was hoping that was the story too, Charlie, when I went out there.
You know, one of the things that we just touched on, and I want to get back to it because I think it's a really important point. We don't want it to be taboo to have a business conference.
Yeah.
You know, these business conferences are going to be the engines of this recovery. People have to get back to doing business.
Yeah.
And if they don't, we're going to keep cycling down instead of begin to cycling up.
Well, you're exactly right. And that was sort of the zeitgeist of the change in Vegas roughly 10, 12, 14 years ago when they collectively, the leaders of the great hotels out there, made a decision of, you know, yeah, we're always going to have the nightlife, we're always going to have the kind of the, you know, sin, quote-unquote sin aspect of Las Vegas, but we want to do more than that. We want it to be a family town. We'll have a theme park. We'll have kid-friendly things in our hotels. We'll have shows that are not just risque or burlesque, but they'll appeal to middle America. We'll have restaurants that, for foodies, we want to have conventions here that are beyond just the annual pornography convention or whatever they do. I mean, and that was a very forward-looking thing. And so Vegas really emerged as the center for a lot of business convention activity, what? Auto shows and advertising conventions and a lot of different things. And they've been set back and for a variety of reasons. But again, you can't have the leader of the free world singling out any given city and saying, don't go there, because then you, as a company, have to say, well, we can't, that would be bad form if we do that.
Right.
Well, it makes you feel better. Francis and I are now saying, go there.
Go to Las Vegas. Yeah. We may come this summer, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'm saying that, you know, when you've got, again, 30 named chefs, great chefs that have restaurants there, and, you know, one of the raps is, well, how often are they there? Well, you know, my whole thing is, I've been to some of the great restaurants in the world where the chef has been there, and the experience has been subpar, and I've also been to some of the great restaurants in the world where the chef hasn't been there, and it's been fantastic. And I think you just judge the experience. But I'd rather have a Wolfgang Puck experience where Wolf is not there. I know it's going to be solid than an experience where a so-called celebrity chef might be there. I don't know. It's you judge it on what it is, but at least they're giving it. These chefs are giving their stamp of approval, and they've got good people, and they've got quality product and everything else. So,
well, the other thing is, you know, we always said, I guess we started our first restaurant in 92, and one of the things we had said was the mark of a restaurant, I think of a great restaurant, is when, or the mark of a great chef and we've employed chefs over the years. We're not chefs ourselves, and we've always said that, you know, one of the marks of whether you're successful or not is how this kitchen runs on your night off, because I think as a chef, it's about creating an organization that is consistent. Chef can't touch every dish anyway, even if he is in the kitchen.
Your comments harken back to the late 70s when Paul Bocuse was traveling and quite a bit, and he was in Japan at one point, and some journalists asked them, and they had to interpret the words for him. Mr. Bocuse, you know, basically, I'm paraphrasing this, you know, you're very important, you're very famous, you travel all over, yet you seem to almost never be in your restaurant. So who's cooking at your restaurant when you're not there? And his response very quickly and spontaneously was, well, the same people that are cooking when I am there.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, I have one. We have to go take a quick break, but I have one story that you brought up, the annual porn convention in Las Vegas. I'm sure that, I don't know that there is one, but we had an experience recently that I'll share with our listeners while you're on the air. There was a porn convention going to be in a nearby.
Well, I just brought that up because my team members keep telling me every year, Chef, you know, there's a pornography convention. It's like, please make sure. The weekends that I come out there, I'm not there during that. It just seems obnoxious.
And well, you know what's...
But you know what? Far be it for me to judge what someone does for a living, and that's fine.
Well, you know, what's funny is, you know, we're in a sleepier, smaller town, and I think the idea of that occasionally a porn convention would go to Las Vegas is not outside the realm of possibility in people's minds. We had in a sort of industrial, sort of out-of-the-way place, there was a porn convention scheduled, and the mayor of the town objected and threatened the liquor license of the hotel that was going to host the porn convention, and so they were basically turned out at the last minute, and they went scrambling for hotels and conference centers throughout New Jersey. And one of the places they picked and booked up, and it's over the course of the summer, which is a slow time in New Brunswick, was the hotel, the 250-room hotel directly across the street from us here in New Brunswick. And we found out on very short notice that there was going to be a porn convention across the street. Ron Jeremy was actually in our bar. He's a famous porn star.
And then you said, whoopee!
You know what's funny? I couldn't figure out how to let people know, because I knew that it would offend some of my people on my mailing list, and it would thrill others on my mailing list. And we didn't do it, but if they ever come back, we've decided how to handle it in the future. We're going to send an email to the entire mailing list stating that we're outraged that there's a porn convention across the street and that people can come and hang out at the bar and meet the porn stars if they want. What do you think?
I think it's great. You may not know this, but I am the staunchest libertarian in America, and so I could care less about pornography. If two people want to engage in something and be filmed and whatever, make money, hey, knock yourselves out.
Or three or four.
Another person. I mean, if you want to gamble and do whatever, if you want to, you know, to me, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt another person.
Hey, I'm with you.
So that's my MO, basically.
And as long as you eat good food before and after. We'll be back.
I hope for that.
We'll be back in just a moment with Charlie Trotter, and we're going to talk about his new book, Home Cooking with Charlie Trotter. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnurr, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is RestaurantGuysChocolate.com, or find the link at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Chef Charlie Trotter, who's been gracious enough to join our show again. He has a current book out called Home Cooking with Charlie Trotter. Now, Charlie, this is a soft cover re-release and a reworking of a book you did about 10 years ago, right?
That's correct. Reworking is the key word. We had a book called Cooking at Home with Charlie Trotter, and this new version is 75% different from the original. We ended up revisiting a number of those recipes. We made some of them simpler. We added some new recipes. We added some color images. So It's reminiscent of the earlier version, but it is very much of its own cookbook.
How do you?
It's our way to take ideas that exist here at a very formal fine dining restaurant, but then to distill them and deconstruct them and make them doable from a home cooking perspective.
What do you do to take a recipe? Talk to me about a recipe that would be done very differently in your restaurant that is inspired something that you have in your cookbook that someone could do at home. And what's the difference between how it's done in a 4-star restaurant, other than, of course, quantity, how it's done in your top-of-the-line restaurant as opposed to how you present it for a home cook?
Well, the first couple of books we came out with literally documented the food as it existed here at Charlie Trotter's. And some of the reviews were, in a word, oh, this is impossible. I can't believe this guy would expect us to do this food at home. And my whole response was, you're missing the point. This food was never intended for a home cook or for somebody to come home after work and make dinner for the family. This is a document of the food that exists at the restaurant. And we ended up writing Gourmet Cooking for Dummies, which I don't know if you know, we did that book, but
right.
Brian Miller, the former restaurant critic of the New York Times, wrote Cooking for Dummies. When he was just about done with that, the folks that published those books approached us and said, gosh, we like your style. We'd like to go to the next level and distill your food for home cooks. That was a very involved book. We had to take our dishes and basically make them approachable for people. But getting on to this particular book, the home cooking book, in some cases we have 4, 5, or 7 sub-recipes for a given dish that have to be made before you even can make the dish. Well, who can cook like that at home unless you're going to entertain on a weekend or something like that? This is rather than using pigeon breast, we're using chicken breast. Rather than using black trumpet mushrooms, we're using button mushrooms. Rather than having multiple steps, it's just here we're sautéing the chicken, and then we're going to add the curry to the mushroom sauté, and now it becomes a sauce, and we're going to spoon it over. And we've eliminated 4 or 5 steps, and it's just the same sort of flavor profile, but it's doable, it's approachable from the home cook standpoint. So that's the basic summation of how we approach this book.
Chef, I'm curious, and I think that a lot of our listeners are probably curious as well. Why does one of the great chefs in America, why are you motivated to write a book for the home cook?
Well, thank you for that question. Why am I motivated to write a book for the home cook? Well, I've written so many books for professionals. The 5 restaurant books, the Charlie Trotter book, which was the original, which profiled a lot of different things. There was a vegetable cookbook, which was, you know, for 21 years, we've offered a vegetarian tasting menu. So that seemed to be a nice fit.
Even before it was avant-garde.
Way before. Now it's sort of de rigueur. Everyone almost has to offer this kind of vegetable food. A seafood cookbook, a meat and game cookbook, a dessert cookbook, those are all restaurant-focused cuisine book. I mean, there are 5 serious books like that. We have some books that are sort of in the intermediate level that kind of profile what we do in our Kitchen Sessions TV show, and a raw food cookbook, a spa book, the management books. But, you know, I thought, hey, let's go through this exercise. Let's take some of the dishes that we do and again, deconstruct them or distill them and take flavor profiles and let's have them workable from the home cooking standpoint. So,
in the years you've been writing cookbooks, and have you seen a change, or is there, you think, a change in what people know about what to cook at home? I think that maybe 20 years ago, the home cook maybe had more of a base of knowledge in a certain way. And today, many home cooks have no real basic fundamentals at all, except for a few enthusiasts who, you know, have an immersion circulator at home. You know, what is the home cook? Who is the home cook you write for? And has the home cook changed?
Well, I don't know. You know, I agree and disagree with what you just said. The part that I agree about is that we have people that don't cook very much anymore, at least nightly. People take meals out of the home, whether it's home meal replacement from a grocery store or something else, or a quick takeout place, or whether it's dining at a restaurant. And then we have people that that are fascinated by cooking. They collect cookbooks. They watch TV shows on the Food Network or on A&E or different channels, and they are completely versant in cuisine and in gastronomy, but they just don't cook. Yet they're able to cook, and they know about food and cooking. So when they do cook, maybe it's once a weekend or once a month, they are willing to go out and shop for marrow bones and hand-cut pasta and a variety of things, and go to farmers markets and spend 2 days cooking all day on a Friday afternoon, all day Saturday, make a dinner Saturday night, or maybe it's for Sunday, whether it's entertaining business friends or just socially or whatever. So you've got a mixture of people that don't really cook as much as they used to, but they know a lot about food, and they're interested in food.
Well, and, you know, it's that subset of people who find it, you know, it used to be, I think, when people wrote cookbooks, it was the cooking was the chore to get through to create this dinner where all your friends would be impressed. And I think a lot of folks really experience, you know, to coin a phrase, the joy of cooking. It's about the cooking itself. That is their weekend. That is their activity.
Yeah, it's like a hobby, or it's a release. You know, my thing is I work hard. I don't have time to cook every night, nor does the wife, because she works, and we got to pick up the kids from after school sports, whatever. We get home. Well, we're gonna get home meal replacement, or we're gonna get takeout food, or we're going to go to a restaurant. But I still love the process, and for some people, it's sort of a meditative thing, and it is a release. So
let me turn the conversation back for a moment to professional cooks. Now you are, without a doubt, one of the best chefs in America. I mean, that's sort of universally recognized. And you did not go to culinary school. You are self-taught, and you apprenticed. Did you apprentice widely or no?
Oh, I just worked in a number of restaurants, and
now,
something led to the next.
Now, one of the things that's changed about young cooks who come out into this world is the question as to whether to go to a culinary school, maybe a culinary school that costs $30,000 a year. You know, and the price of some of the culinary schools has really gotten very high. One of the things that I like about the restaurant business, we were in a city that was a rather depressed city when we opened our restaurant, and it's a rather thriving city right now. And one of the ways it became a thriving city is it's got a vibrant theater and restaurant scene. And, you know, restaurants employ a lot of people. We have a lot of employees per dollar, a lot of employees per square foot. And one of the things I like about our industry is it provides jobs for all sorts of people, people with college degrees and people without college degrees, people who maybe when they start working can't even speak English. And they can wind up in a number of years becoming an accomplished chef, owning their own restaurant or whatever it is they choose to do. I see some kids coming out of culinary school who come and apply for a job. That's basically a $10 an hour job that if they put their, you know, their shoulder to the wheel and really push, maybe in a year or two it's a $15 an hour job. And they come out with $120,000 worth of debt from culinary school. And I'm wondering in the whole, because people ask me sometimes, well, should I go to culinary school? And I think, well, if you can, you know, travel and get just apprenticed with people, I think that may be a better way. I'm really torn with expensive culinary schools. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have a problem with folks that literally out of high school go to culinary school. If that's what if they want to be a cook, or they think they do, and they think it might be a great life opportunity or career opportunity, and my perspective is nothing more than get some life experience before you go on to culinary school experience, and that could happen in different ways. Let's say you graduate from high school, and you really want to be a cook, a chef, or whatever your dream is. From that standpoint, you should either, hopefully, and in this day and age more than ever, go on and get a 4-year academic degree. Get a degree in English literature. Get a degree in history. Get a degree in philosophy. Get a degree in political science.
That is always my advice.
You can cook in the summers. You can cook on the weekends. You can get jobs, whatever. Then from there, you can pursue your thing. The skill set that a chef needs today, or a restaurateur, or an operator of a business that we're in, a hospitality business, it's so beyond just do I know how to cook. And you need communication skills. You need writing skills. You need to be able to formulate ideas and think critically. So I get these calls all the time from parents that say, oh, my son or my daughter, they're, you know, it's a, she or he is a senior in high school and they really want to be a cook or a chef, and what culinary school should they go to? And my response is, can they get in, and can you as a family afford to send them to a four-year academic school, get a liberal arts background, then call me in 4 years and I'll give you some advice on culinary schools. Well, oftentimes they're shocked to hear that. And then if that's not in the realm of possibility, either from an academic perspective or from a financial perspective, I say, well, then they shouldn't even go to culinary school yet. They need at least 2 full years of working.
Yeah.
So that they can get it. They can pick up knife skills. They can identify food products. They can identify when food products are ripe or in season. They know how to break down a duck or a halibut or a part of a side of beef or something. And then when they get to cooking school, they'll already be at a certain level where they've cooked on a hotline or they've worked in a fast food restaurant or they've gained some skills. But when I've seen these young people that go right to culinary school and they're 18, 19 years old. They have no life experience. They have no actual technical background experience. They have no academic experience. And the whole thing goes right over their head.
Yeah.
To your point, one ought not to be paying $30,000 a year to learn how to work with a knife. One could get a job. Hey, go. You know what? If you're going to spend that kind of money, go volunteer. If nobody's hiring, say, you know what? I'm living with my parents, and I can work for free. I just want to work here for the next 6 months. If you can show me anything, well, you'll learn so much that when you finally get a paying job or get onto culinary school, it'll pay off in dividends to you. So, that's my little sermon on that subject.
Hear, hear.
But even beyond that, how many people do we all know who fell in love with the romance of cooking, fell in love with the romance of being a chef, and then 3, 4, 5 months into actually working on a line and figuring out how physically demanding it is, said, I just can't do this. I don't want to do this.
Right.
Oh, sure. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. But do you want to be on this side or that side of culinary school when you make that realization?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, but the other thing, too, is, you know, we've got people now that will... I'll interview them. Why are you interested in this field? Oh, well, I think it's really exciting, and, you know, I see myself in 3 years having my own TV show or writing cookbooks, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't want to crush these people, but I'm thinking you could interview the top chefs in America right now. Again, household name people, basically, at least in the culinary world. Emeril Lagasse, Mario Batali, Wolfgang Puck, Thomas Keller, Jean-Georges Vongerichten, Eric Ripert, Daniel Boulud. I'm sure I'm leaving out many names, but if you were to have asked any of these guys 20 years ago, or in some cases 30 years ago, when they started off in this field, hey, what do you want to do? They all would have said the same thing. I just love food. I love cooking. I just want to be around this. Not one of these people ever dreamed about writing their own cookbook or opening multiple restaurants or being on TV. That was never part of the driving force. And that's why they're successful today, because they just love what they do. And, yeah. Oh, by the way, now we have more opportunity than ever. People come by and they say, hey, would you like to open another restaurant? Or would you, you know, we'll bankroll this? Or how about your own product line? And that's sort of like a perk of the occupation if you're good at it. But you don't go into this line of work saying, you know, some of these TV shows that sort of, hey, if you win the competition, we're going to bankroll an opening restaurant for you. Well, there's... people are never going to be successful.
Well, what do you think?
That's fantasy.
What do you think about the line of all the different TV shows that sort of? I like Top Chef. I think that's sort of the most relevant to reality. But there's a whole line of TV shows, and I think I'm getting a little bit sick of food as competition. What?
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with all that. That's not what it's about. And you got to love service. You got to love the cuisine side and the procuring of the product and investing your heart and soul into what you do. It's not about how fast can I do it or am I going to beat that chef. It's more like how much can I learn and am I willing to commit myself to the long run to this? Am I going to do this and say, all right, I think that in 30 years I'm still going to be on fire. I'm going to be excited about what I do and I'm going to try to improve what I do on a daily basis. When we first opened Trotters 22 years ago, I was all obsessed with, oh, we got to be the best, and we got to outdo this restaurant or that restaurant in Chicago, and then nationwide, and then and then beyond. And then maybe about 10 years into it, I realized that was sort of a less than worthy goal or objective. And it's more about you got to compete against yourself and say, all right, how do you refine what you do every day at your restaurant and try to make it a little better? And maybe it's not so noticeable. In the early days of any business, you can see the growth by leaps and bounds, but are you willing to stick it out and do it for a long period of time, and then the growth becomes not so easy to monitor because it's happening in these incremental sorts of ways.
Yeah.
17 years into this, Francis and I still have a mantra of, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse.
Oh.
And it's
because the problem is you learn more and you realize how much you don't know. You thought you knew something and you're like, damn,
absolutely.
I didn't even know anything about Indian cuisine. That's a whole other thing I got to start studying. And it's endless.
Write that down, Mark. Indian cuisine. That's our next. That's our next.
But that's the beauty of it. It's like, you know, it's never ending.
It's true. It's true. Well, we have to take a quick break. We'll come back for another segment with Charlie Trotter. And I want to talk with you about stocks and briefly about molecular gastronomy. We'll be back in just a moment with Chef Charlie Trotter. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, with Charlie Trotter. We're talking about, among other things, his new book, Home Cooking with Charlie Trotter. Charlie, I want to talk about the book just a little bit. It's a wonderful book for people to have at home, and it's a paperback. It's really manageable or a soft cover, I should say, right? Really manageable to have in the kitchen. You talk a lot about stocks in your current book. Would you say that stocks are the most basic part of home cook's cuisine?
Well, it is a basic part because once you've made a stock, and it doesn't have to be as complicated as the old-fashioned, you know, roast the veal bones for 3 hours and then sauté them and then put them in with some water and then strain the water, add new water, and then, you know, we all went through the classic way to do that. A stock could be anything. I mean, if you take some trimmings of mushrooms and simmer them with a little water, a little red wine, and then strain that after an hour and reduce that. That could be the basis for almost anything, whether it's a vinaigrette or then adding chicken bones and then making it even more concentrated or flavorful. So I just think these are little enhancements that can add flavor elements to food. It doesn't have to be this big involved process.
I think a lot of people are intimidated by stocks because they think they're very complex. And for the most part, I don't find stocks to become, they're time-consuming, but they're not very complex.
Well, and they're actually not time-consuming, because once you kind of get some stuff in a pot, whether it's a bunch of vegetables or a bunch of vegetables and a fish carcass or some chicken bones, once you get it at a simmer and you skim a little bit, you can leave it more or less unattended. Every once in a while you come back and skim, and depending on what you're doing, 3 hours or 5 hours later, you can get everything removed and strained, and then you've got a base of something, and then you can reduce it, and it can be the base of a soup, or you can incorporate a puree of a vegetable and make it, you know, a sauce or anything you want. So,
well, there's so much that really is simple, but there are a lot of pitfalls to watch out for, and you'll find yourself warned about them in Charlie Trotter's new book, Home Cooking with Charlie Trotter. Charlie, thanks for being on the show.
Chef, always a pleasure.
Guys, it's always great to talk to you. I appreciate the conversation. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
And you should go out and visit Charlie's restaurant in Chicago. You can find out more about Charlie Trotter and his book at www.restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You know, if you're looking for a perfect restaurant or a home-cooked meal in the Garden State, look no further than Dining Out Magazine, New Jersey. Dining Out's the premier dining guide for northern and central Jersey. It provides the right information to help you make your dining decisions. Whether you're looking for a romantic dinner, a power lunch, entertaining a large group, finding the perfect caterer, or just a night out on the town, Dining Out provides a sample menu, beautiful pictures and reviews, and over 100 of the best restaurants in the state are included. Of course, Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left among them. Dining Out Magazine and DiningOut.com are the go-to dining resource for the Garden State. Aside from comprehensive restaurant listings, cooking section. You'll also find in every issue recipes from your favorite chefs, profiles, interviews, and features on dining trends, both in the state and around the country. The latest edition explores the hidden treasures of rural Italy, the finest Italian foods made only by hand, a do-it-yourself journal of wine, beer, and cheese, and unique cocktails from seasoned bartenders throughout the Garden State. Not to mention a list of upcoming events, classes, and charity events hand-picked by Dining Out's senior editors. You can pick up your copy today at Barnes & Noble, Borders, Whole Foods, or visit them at www.diningout.com to view all the restaurants listed and join their subscription list. Dining Out is the ultimate must-have resource to feed the inner foodie in you. That's at diningout.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Charlie Trotter, Big Fish, or one of our first Big Fishes.
That's true.
He's back on the show many years later. He's fun.
He is fun. He wrote some of the most important books as far as owning a restaurant and running a restaurant. I know a lot of people who listen are restaurant professionals and people in the business. And for all of those people, I recommend that you pick up two books that Charlie wrote a while back. It's got to be over 10 years ago. Lessons in Service, and then he wrote a book called Lessons in Excellence. And those two books for a restaurant professional, I think, are two of the most important pieces ever written, because they just really get into the nuance of what the expectation is to be excellent and to offer great service.
Well, and I think the lessons of those books apply out beyond the restaurant industry. You know, Charlie, for a long time, I haven't looked recently, but I know for a while there that corporations were hiring him as a, not as a motivational speaker necessarily, but as a speaker on organizations and building enthusiastic organizations, because that's what a restaurant is, you know? And I find him inspirational in that way. And this book for the home cook, this most recent book, is not about that. It's about being a home cook. I also think what he said about culinary schools was wise advice.
I agree. He's got another book coming out in this series on the Lessons in Service, Lessons in Excellence. It's a book called Lessons in Wine Service. Hopefully we'll bring him back on the show when that book comes out, and after we've read it, and we can talk a little bit about that book and probably the other two service books as well.
Well, and this summer, it's my intention actually to finally make it to Chicago and go to Trotter's in Chicago.
We've been talking about it for 3 years, so.
When we heard that he had played our last interview for his staff, I thought, oh, I got to go out and visit that guy. You know, he's not opening in New York, but I got to go visit him out there. Well, anyway, I hope you've all enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, WCTC AM, and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.